This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. You know we're on Twitter, at KUOW. Will Seattle's next mayor listen to Republicans? That's what one audience member asked the candidates at last night's mayoral debate.
Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant has publicly lauded the fact she's not friends with any Republicans. As mayor for all Seattle residents, not just those in your own party, will you commit to listening to all perspectives and opinions, and please describe how you plan to do so?
KUOW's politics reporters David Hyde and Amy Radel were following along at that debate. Thank you both for stopping by.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill.
David, talking to Republicans, is that the third rail of Seattle politics?
You know, Trump did get 8% of the vote here, but I don't know how many Republicans are actually out of the closet about that.
How did the candidates respond?
Here's urban planner Carrie Moon.
Absolutely, I'll listen.
And former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin.
We are all tired of the division in Washington, D.C., and the kind of president that Trump is, Seattle's got to be better than that.
Okay, they're both going to be good listeners.
Exactly.
Homelessness was another subject that came up at this debate. Should people be allowed to camp in places where it's illegal, like public parks? And what did you hear?
Carrie Moon said yes.
I will stop the sweeps because I believe chasing people who have nowhere else to go is unjust and inhumane and inefficient. We are wasting so much money moving people when we should be helping them get inside.
And I was at the debate watch party at Optimism Brewing on Capitol Hill mm-hmm. last night, where a lot of people came in saying they were favoring Moon, and that line in particular got a lot of applause.
And back at the debate, Jenny Durkin said that the current city policy on illegal encampments, which Moon had been calling sweeps, is more humane.
Outreach workers and police officers together go into the illegal encampments and they meet with people. They see what services they need. They talk to them. I went with them last week. And I will tell you, every person in Seattle would be so proud of what they do. They are not sweeping.
And just to be clear, Durkin was saying that city policy has changed and improved. They were not well done, but she thinks that they've made some strides in that area.
With the navigation teams, right.
Okay, and she thinks city workers are not sweeping. Also, the candidates were asked whether they had calculated the total cost of all their campaign promises.
Yeah, and they've made a lot of these. More money for homelessness, more money for affordable housing, free tuition. Here's Carrie Moon.
Nope. When I get into office, I will sit down with the budget office and with council and look, first refine them into what's viable and effective, and then work together to understand the costs and get the costs at a place where we can meet our goals but not spend too much money.
And here's Jenny Durkin on whether or not she's added up all the costs.
Each of the proposals that we have done, we've not only identified how much that will cost, but where I'm going to get it from.
And what's the total?
The total for all of them?
Yes.
I'll give you that at the end. I mean, I could total up in my brain, but I think it comes to about, let me get that number back to you exactly, because I'm going through tuition and vouchers and the like.
Russ and I got an email this morning saying they're still working on that. We're going to get a total later today, maybe.
Yes, that was KUOW co-debate moderator Ross Reynolds pressing the candidate there. And also in this debate, Amazon, no surprise, came up. So we've got now a total of 238 North American cities and towns wanting to be Amazon's second headquarters. And the candidates told us what advice they would share from here in HQ1.
Yeah, they said much the same thing in some ways, but there was a slightly different emphasis. Urban planner Carrie Moon said Amazon's growth has been good for Seattle, but her advice to other cities was,
be careful what you wish for. We have not planned in advance for all the growth that Amazon brought with them. So we need some time to catch up. So I would advise other cities to plan the growth in advance, understand what it's going to cost, and make sure Amazon's going to help pay for it.
And former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin agreed that Amazon's caused some problems. It's helped contribute to inequality, but
I think it is wrong for us to say we're going to roll up the welcome mat. We're going to quit growing. We're not going to be that city that invents the next future.
And one of the things that came up last night was that Jenny Durkin has gotten significant campaign support from businesses, including Amazon.
Okay. And Amazon came up again later in the debate, too. The candidates were sharing which group they know the least and how they've tried to get to know that group in Seattle and how they respond to that.
Jenny Durkin said the East African community, and Carrie Moon said,
so I really am focused on how do we help the tech workers feel more welcome in our city? And, you know, in the old days in the small town I grew up in, there was really a literal thing called a welcome wagon, where you went to newcomers to town and introduced them to the town and showed them around and, you know, introduce them to the coffee shops and the churches and the businesses. And I feel like we need to do something like that with tech workers.
A welcome wagon for tech workers.
Yeah, she thinks they need to be better integrated into the city of Seattle, you know, hanging out with Newt Berger or whatever.
How would that work then?
I'm picturing instead of fresh baked pies, maybe they've got the robots from Westworld delivering silicon chips.
Right. Now, Amy Raley, you watched from a viewing party. You said you were at a brewery on Capitol Hill. And how did Jenny Durkin and Carrie Moon do with the brewery crowd?
Well, you know, obviously it was anecdotal in terms of who I talked to, but it was a packed event. It was young people. A lot of them described themselves as progressives, professionals in Seattle. They were very attentive during the debate. It wasn't just on in the background. They were, you know, really paying full attention. A lot of them, especially at the beginning, said they support Moon. Some had even already cast their ballots for her, even though we just got our ballots. But after the debate, I was kind of surprised to run into several people who said they had come in undecided and they were going home with more interest in Durkin and wanting to do some more research about her. And one of those people was Kelsey Temple.
I think Moon has a lot of things that I really admire and think would be a great addition, but she didn't have the same level of detail as far as execution that Durkin did. And I think I have more faith that at least what Durkin's ideas are will get done.
So Durkin's been stressing her experience, saying she has better experience to get done the things that she has promised so far. It seems like that argument is persuasive to people, but there's a little bit of tension there because people also really like both candidates and they want to feel good and idealistic about this race. And so if Durkin gets too negative in terms of seeming to criticize Carrie Moon's experience, it seems like that could deflate some of that overall enthusiasm from the voters.
And what I was hearing last night from both sides, because there was people supporting Moon, people supporting Durkin, was either way, they kind of felt good about this. It isn't like some other elections where the earth may stop spinning. In this one, they kind of felt like, okay, Seattle's going to be okay.
That's partisanship Seattle style in a two-person mayoral race. KUOW's Amy Radel and David Hyde, our politics reporters, following this for you. Thanks a lot to both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in just a moment. Speaking of politics, there is a law in Washington state that lets you petition a court to involuntarily commit a mentally ill family member. It's called Joel's Law. Well, in Pierce County, nearly every Joel's Law petition is granted. But in King County, most petitions are rejected. KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins asked judges in both counties what's going on.
In a small courtroom on the campus of Western State Hospital.
Thank you. Good morning, and please be seated.
Pierce County Court Commissioner Craig Adams presides over Civil Mental Health Court.
This is a request for up to 14 days of treatment.
Commissioner Adams' job is to decide if mental health patients meet the criteria for involuntary commitment under state law. The test is whether the person poses a danger to themselves or others or is gravely disabled.
I do believe that in this case, by a preponderance of the evidence, it is established as to grave disability.
Most of the time, Adams is hearing from lawyers and mental health professionals, but once a month or so, he gets a Joel's Law petition from a family.
It is usually due to some story that the family has about their family member being very mentally ill and not receiving what they believe to be appropriate intervention or treatment.
By the time a Joel's Law petition is filed, a designated mental health professional, or DMHP, has decided the person doesn't qualify for involuntary treatment. Adams must decide if that was the right decision or the wrong decision. In 90% of the cases he's reviewed, Adams has sided with the family, not the DMHP.
So we're saying, no, we think you need to detain that person.
Why is this happening? Adams says in some cases the DMHPs are placing too high a bar for an initial 72-hour commitment.
I think that they have committed an error on the side of being too conservative and not aggressive enough in at least referring the people for at least the 72-hour hold. And that's just my own prejudice after reading them.
For a startling contrast to Pierce County, consider what's happening with Joel's Law in King County. Of 57 Joel's Law petitions filed there since the law took effect in 2015, only one has been granted. Johanna Bender is a King County Superior Court judge who hears these petitions.
I actually have a family member who has touched the involuntary mental health system himself. So I am very familiar with the pain and the fear and the uncertainty that goes along with being the family member of a loved one in crisis.
But Bender calls involuntary commitment a pretty radical deprivation of their civil liberty.
There are times when it is very, very clear to me that the respondent is in a tremendous amount of crisis, that the family is in a tremendous amount of crisis, that there are very, very serious unmet treatment needs, but that the law does not permit the use of involuntary hospitalization to meet those needs.
Joel's Law is named after Joel Reuter, a mentally ill man who was shot and killed by Seattle police in 2013. His father, Doug Reuter, is concerned with the track record of King County judges.
There cannot be only one case that the DMHP in King County got wrong over a two-year period.
As for the dramatically different story in Pierce County?
What it tells me is that there's at least one judge in Pierce County, maybe more, that feels the way I do about the DMHP, and they don't trust him.
I believe our DMHPs are doing the best job they can.
This is Sylvia Riley, who oversees Pierce County's DMHPs. Riley says she's been surprised at how many times her staff's decisions have been overturned.
We take very seriously the fact that we don't want to take somebody's rights away.
Riley says while she respects the court's decision, a couple of the Joel's Law cases have been tough on her DMHPs.
It kind of broke their heart because, you know, this person's like, why? Why am I going there? I've been taking my medications.
As of March of this year, nearly two-thirds of Joel's Law petitions statewide were dismissed. Of those that were granted, most were in Pierce County. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. You pay a tax every time you fill up your car. We have one of the highest gas taxes in the country here, about 49 cents a gallon. How would you feel about paying less in gas tax and instead paying for every mile you drive? Would that be more fair? Would that be less fair? Let's ask the director of the Washington State Transportation Center, Mark Hallenbeck. Welcome back.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Washington State is starting this pilot program in January. Why does the state want to shift to pay by mile?
So the main reason they are trying to shift to pay by mile is the gas tax becomes unworkable in the future. When you stop driving the 67 Chevy Impala and you now drive the Toyota Prius, you drive a whole lot more miles per penny you pay to the state to fix the roads.
Shouldn't we be rewarded for that?
You are.
Hey, you got an efficient car, you pay less tax.
Yeah, and in some respects that's great, but from a funding source to pay for the roads you're using on, it's a disaster. Mm. So they're looking at ways to replace the gas tax with something equitable.
Equitable. That's a controversial word. What's equitable? You like this pay-by-mile idea. Why do you like it?
I like it because it does what the original gas tax, and we're talking 1920s, was designed to do. It was designed to have people who use the roads pay to use the roads. So that's to me, that's one great definition of what's equitable. If you use it, you pay for it. The more you use it, the more you pay for it. Our problem is that gasoline is no longer a fair way to do that because some people don't use it at all. I drive a Tesla. I don't, but, okay. And they don't pay any gas tax. So the legislature picked a value. I think it's $100 extra on your registration fee, but that doesn't have anything to do with whether you drive 100 miles or 100,000 miles in that car.
Well, but we're talking about what's fair now. You got a Tesla, and you're not polluting the environment as much. And the problem with any car usage fee, Mark, as you know, is that some people need or feel they need to drive to their job or their family. It's not a joyride.
Well, I agree. And the gasoline tax had the ability to say, hey, burning fuel is a bad thing. It has consequences, and therefore, if you burn more, you should pay more. Now, you lose that when you go to the per mile fee. You might have a different, if that's what you're trying to capture, you might change registration fees to capture that portion of it. You mentioned at the start that we have a high gas tax. We have a high gas tax because we have very low other taxes on our vehicles and our vehicle usage.
And no income tax.
And no income tax. Yeah. So, I mean, it's that mix that's necessary. And the problem is the gas tax in and of itself, particularly into the future, has real significant problems.
But what if you work in Seattle, but you can't afford to live there? You live in Maple Valley or Linwood or Sammamish. That's why you bought a hybrid or electric or efficient car. Now the state's going to change the rules on you and charge you for not being able to afford to live in Seattle?
Well, the question I could return without answering yours is, well, so who should pay for the roads that you're using? If you're not going to pay for the roads, why should I, who ride my bike into work, pay for the roads? So you can live in Maple Valley?
Fair question.
And that's the real question, comes down to how do you pay for roads? And that's a different question in many respects than how do we tax people in general. I'm a big fan of user fees. If you use something, you pay for it, right? And that changes. If we change the cost of driving, that would change the cost of housing.
How would it affect the cost of housing?
Well, if you make it expensive to drive long distances, then people will be less willing to move out. They'll be more willing to live close. What would happen is the prices in close would go up even more, and the prices for houses would go down outside.
Yeah.
And you would... there would be a new balancing of what people are willing to pay.
How would the state know how far I'm driving?
So there are multiple ways to do this. The easiest, simplest way is I, a public official, look at your odometer once a year, once every 6 months, mm-hmm. right? And that works. The second thing you can do is have a device kind of like the snapshot that you can get from Progressive, right, where you plug it into your car and it follows you around and reports aggregated statistics. This is how many miles you drove. You can have such a device with a GPS in it, right? And the GPS knows to stop counting when you leave the state of Washington and say, here are your Washington miles, right? Wow. And it's still doing that process. You can have a smartphone that connects to your car so that it knows that you're walking around downtown aren't miles you're driving. So it has to recognize that it's in the car, right? And it does the same kind of thing. It can be more sophisticated. It can actually know what road you're on, right? It can say, okay, you're on I-5 and that's really good if you're trying to give money back to Kirkland, right? You want to know how many miles are in Kirkland. So if you track Kirkland separately from the rest of the state of Washington, you can say, oh, this is how many miles are in Kirkland. So the level of sophistication can change.
Maybe not so good if you don't want the state of Washington to know whether you're in Kirkland or not.
That's correct. And so that's why you choose, and the Transportation Commission is trying very hard to give you options to find out how people do. And they want options everywhere from the very simple. You're going to look at my odometer and you don't know when I leave the state, but that's my choice. I want to choose a simple number where you don't know anything about me, but okay, I'm going to write you a check, versus, okay, you know exactly how much is in the state of Washington, for driving is in the state of Washington, how much is not, and I'm only paying you for what I owe you, right? And okay, that's cool, but then you have to be able to keep track of those miles. And technically, that's not hard. Technically, doing that and also keeping your privacy is harder, but again, there are lots of ways to do that technically. And the question at the commission is, what's acceptable to people? How does it work? Can we do the audit process to make sure it's fair, that people can't cheat easily?
Talking with Mark Hallenbeck, director of the Washington State Transportation Center at the University of Washington, talking about this pilot program. It looks like the state is very interested in charging you eventually by the miles you drive and less by the gas tax. Mark, as we start charging by the mile, will the gas tax go away or will we pay both?
Again, I'm not a legal scholar on this stuff, but my understanding is the gas tax will slowly decline and miles charged would probably go up to replace it.
Because some people are suspicious. They think, the state's going to end up double charging me.
Yeah, I'm sure that. And again, that's why I suspect the per mile tax would go up.
Yeah.
The idea is not necessarily to double your taxes. The idea is to phase gas tax out and phase per mile charges in.
But will pay by mile cost the average person more or less than the old gas tax when it's once it's old?
Well, ask the legislature. Are they trying to increase revenue or not?
Right.
The test is about a one-for-one replacement.
Okay.
Right? So cool. Great. Not a problem. On the other hand, if you look 20 years from now, that it would cost you more because you're now driving lots of electric vehicles where you're not paying any gas tax, right?
And so what that's true. If you're comparing the two.
Right.
Yes.
They're trying to like keep it before it falls apart completely.
Okay. But they claim revenue neutral.
Right. They're looking at maintaining the revenue stream they have now.
Okay. So Mark, we've just gone through some pros and cons of pay by mile. It sounds like a possibly unpopular idea. One state poll found 58% of people opposed to a pay by mile charge. Is the public going to stop this from happening in Washington State?
Good question. I have no clue. The results in California have been that once people test it, they seem to like it. So people always resist the unknown. I will say that.
Yeah.
There are certainly reasons why you would not like it, particularly if you haven't experienced it. On the other hand, it might turn out to be a better way to go. A real question comes back to, well, how do you want to pay for your roads, right? I always like to phrase it that way. It's you and your roads. If you don't want to pay per mile, how would you like to pay for your roads? Do you want property tax? You want gas tax? You want income tax? I don't care.
You hear that, listener? He's asking for your input. You can go to KOW's Facebook page. You can go to Twitter at KOW. Send us an email, record@kuow.org. Mark Hallenbeck from the State Transportation Center wants to know what you think of all of this. Now, speaking of ways we charge people to drive, there is a Seattle City Council member who wants to study congestion pricing like they have in London and some other places where you pay extra to drive into the city at certain times. Will the idea we've been discussing, tracking the miles you drive, is that going to lead to the state eventually charging, being able to have the technology to charge you also for driving, let's say, downtown at certain times?
If everyone goes to a GPS-based system, you could do that. The Puget Sound Regional Council actually ran a major test, probably 10 years ago now, that determined how people interact with different prices on different roads at different times of the day. Right. And correctly, people's behavior changed as a result of that in interesting ways. And so the transportation purists look at that and say, great, let's do this. We can manage it. Whether the public finds that acceptable or not is a fascinating question. And the answer is usually it depends, like all transportation planning questions, it depends. And mostly it depends on whether they like where the money is going and they think it's a reasonable and fair approach. So my quick example of this is Stockholm. Stockholm put a ring around the city and you had to drive in and they took all the money and put lots of transit service. And they said, we're going to do this as a 6-month test and then you get to vote. And they did the test. Everybody inside Stockholm was happy. Everybody outside Stockholm who was driving in was pissed. They voted.
How about that?
They voted no. All the people in charge lost, right? They were out. Mm. The next group came in and said, well, how about this version? We're going to put this toll ring around and all the money that gets spent goes to the suburbs. And the people who lived inside Stockholm who liked the traffic going away and the better bus service voted yes. The people who got the money in the far suburbs voted yes.
Huh.
And the people who paid to drive into the city voted no. And the two groups who liked it outvoted the people who didn't like it.
Right.
Right. So where the money went was far more important than whether, in fact, this toll ring existed or not. And so to date, that's what Stockholm's got, right? And so it's as much about where the money is as it's about transportation. Inside Stockholm, it's transportation. Outside Stockholm, it's about who's taxing me and who gets the money.
Okay. That's an instructive little story there, as Seattle might consider congestion pricing.
And here is, by the way, the same thing happened in London, and the guy who put the London charge in got voted out of office, and that's how London's version of Donald Trump got elected.
Is that right? Okay. You're learning a lot from Mark Hallenbeck, the director of the Washington State Transportation Center. But here's an objection to congestion pricing from last night's mayoral debate. This is candidate Carrie Moon.
Congestion pricing puts too much burden on low-income folks, especially folks who have to drive for work or folks who are not well served by transit because they're in a low-income neighborhood, they don't have political power, they don't have much voice, they don't have transit. We absolutely have to get the transit in place before we can consider something like congestion pricing.
Does congestion pricing put an unfair burden on low-income people?
Define fair. But
yeah,
sure,
here we go again.
But sure, yeah. And they are the people who have the hardest time paying for it. I mean, I've proposed many tolling plans in my life, mostly for so people could look at them. And you know, the biggest problem is, hey, even if I'm not a poor person and I buy this house in Mill Creek or in Puyallup or whatever because I need these attributes in my house and I can afford that, right? Life is great and yeah, it's going to be a crappy commute, but I make that trade, okay? Cool. When you come in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years later and say, "Oh yeah, well you used to take an hour, right? And now you're going to get in half an hour, but you're going to pay me $4 each way." I can't make that trade, not because I wouldn't like the half an hour back each way in my life, because I don't have the $4 times two times 21 days a month. I simply don't have it. So it's not just the poor when you retrofit congestion pricing if they don't have alternatives. My argument with Carrie Moon is there are too many communities. It, because of the way we've built our communities, where the roads go, where they don't go, where density is, where it isn't, there are too many communities that you cannot serve efficiently with transit. And those people are stuck in congestion pricing because they don't have good alternatives and you can't give them good alternatives.
Well, couldn't technology tell us their zip code and they don't get charged congestion pricing if they don't have a transit option?
So the solutions then become, technologically and socially, are you willing to give particular people tax breaks in some way, shape, or form? Great. Everybody has to have, and you all have a license plate on your car. Great. Make it electronic so it's easy to track when vehicles go down the road. And, you know, people who qualify for food stamps get 16 trips for free on I-5, right? I'm just making this stuff up.
Right.
And now you could either use those or you could sell them. I mean, hey, it'd be a great new social service on how you distributed value, right? And it's because maybe they don't need them for trips, but they could, instead of food stamps, they could sell their free trips to people who want to buy those free trips. So you have a new market and there's, you know, it gets really complicated really quickly.
Yeah.
As you're trying to deal with what's fair.
Here's another idea for reducing traffic from last night's mayoral debate. This is Seattle mayoral candidate Jenny Durkin.
I want to work with the big employers, and if I'm mayor, I'm going to do it, to say to Amazon, to Starbucks, whoever, how about on Monday 20% of your workforce doesn't come in, they work from home. On Tuesday, a different 20%. On Wednesday, a different 20%. So we literally have fewer people coming in.
Why don't big employers shift? I've heard this for decades. Shift the old agricultural workday that starts at sunrise, when the sun illuminates our fields. What's stopping big employers from making that change? It would help congestion.
They do.
Oh,
they do tremendously.
More than we realize.
More.
They've already
had more than you realize. Absolutely. Many employers start early, start late. You have flex time on when you go. That actually helps spread that. I mean, our commute period is 4 hours now, right? Why is it 4 hours? Because there are a lot of people coming in at 6 o'clock in the morning. Have you been on I-5? You know, at 5:30, and I-5 coming up from Tacoma is packed at 5:30. Those people are coming in early and they're going home early.
Do you think we've shifted as much as we're going to, or is the shift going to be just accelerate?
I think there will be continued shifts. I told somebody the other day, University of Washington is much bigger now than we were in 1984. And yet the traffic that we generate in terms of cars to the university is dramatically lower than what we used to do there, even though we're considerably bigger, right? So those same things are happening. They just don't happen fast enough, big enough.
Yeah. You can see me most days pulling into the light rail station lower campus and riding a bike share up the hill across the campus.
And, you know, hooray, and those things are great. And then we'll have to deal with, well, how are the bike share being left in the right places? And how you, I mean, it's just, it's one question after another.
That should be the new name of KUOW's The Record. We'll change that to, hi, I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to One Question After Another. And my guest has been answering questions and exchanging ideas and pros and cons as we talk about how to charge the driving, how to charge us for the driving we do. Mark Hallenbeck, director of the Washington State Transportation Center, University of Washington. Great to see you again, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And on Facebook, we asked you what you think about pay by mile. Nick says it sounds strange, but it's more fair than the current system. Al says taxing people per mile is extremely unfair for people who can't afford to live in the city but have to commute in for work. John says remove the gas tax, and I would be fine with it. Justice has this idea. It would need to be based not only on miles, but gross vehicle weight. Charging a smart car the same amount as a Hummer stretch limo is senseless. And on Twitter, Leslie writes, so will bike riders finally be charged for using the roads? And on Twitter, Tara says, why not just install toll booths like we have on the East Coast? Hashtag too complicated. Thanks all. Thanks for listening. Thanks for responding. More of The Record coming right back at you. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. 21 kids between the ages of 10 and 21 are suing the federal government for not taking definitive action on climate change. They claim the government is violating their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. The Trump administration is trying to get the case dismissed, and a ruling on that is expected any day now. In the latest episode of KUOW's podcast, Terrestrial, host Ashley Ahern introduces us to one of the young plaintiffs.
Victoria Barrett likes to wear baseball hats and jeans. She listens to Kanye and Kendrick Lamar, and she was really looking forward to her high school's retreat junior year. But she got there late, right in the middle of the talent show, and in no mood to party.
Now I'm in a room like full of screaming, dancing girls, and I can't, like, I was like, does nobody know what's happening in the world? Like, how is anyone happy right now? Like, how is anyone having a good time?
Victoria wasn't feeling the vibe that night because she'd just come from the United Nations, where she'd been talking about the lawsuit she's involved in to try to force the federal government to take action on climate change. It's called Juliana versus the United States. Victoria and her fellow plaintiffs claim that the government is violating their constitutional rights by supporting the use of the fossil fuels that are the biggest source of climate pollution. It's an unprecedented lawsuit. Some legal experts have called it radical. Victoria just calls it necessary.
It seemed like another way to make change. And I've always really been into government, and taking action through the judicial branch sounded really interesting. So I was like, yeah, I'm down for that.
And there's an even deeper resonance for her. Victoria's mom is from Honduras, and developing countries like that are in the crosshairs of the climate crisis.
Sea level rise really impacts the coasts of Honduras, but, you know, they're not the ones contributing mostly to the issue. You know, the people who are contributing the least amount to climate change and the least amount of carbon emissions to the world are the ones being most affected by it.
But being from Honduras, her mom was concerned about Victoria getting involved in a lawsuit against the government.
You could tell, like, maybe she thought the CIA or FBI was going to be watching me or something. She just seemed very, she's like, don't you want to work for the government, Tori? You don't think this could be bad for you or anything? And I was like, no, this sounds awesome. Like, I want to do it.
Victoria's mom eventually came to understand her position. But things with her dad have been tougher.
He thinks that some of the rhetoric around it is just inflammatory and wants to make people scared. And I think my dad is really smart. I just think that he's wrong about this specific issue.
Victoria says she and her dad have had a lot of hard conversations about climate change. But ultimately, she says he respects the fact that she's doing research and taking action against what she sees as inequality. The lawyers representing her and the other plaintiffs will argue that the government knew about the dangerous effects of burning fossil fuels and put the lives of citizens at risk by allowing companies to mine coal and drill for oil on public lands. And they'll ask the courts to require the federal government to commit to reducing CO2 levels in the atmosphere.
Like, I don't want to have to do this. It's just, I feel like it obviously needs to be done. Like, young people need to be speaking about this issue because other people aren't dealing with it to the same extent, like to the extent that they really should be. It sometimes, you know, it's frustrating to think about the fact that sometimes I feel like people my age are fighting the hardest when really, like, we didn't even start this in the first place.
This fall, Victoria is a freshman at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she plans to study environmental and political science. I'm Ashley Ahern.
Ashley's the host of the KUOW podcast, Terrestrial, new season just underway. Get that wherever you podcast. You can hear the full episode about Victoria and her lawsuit and subscribe to the podcast by heading to our website, kuow.org. Six years ago, Seattle poet Tara Hardy was blindsided by a mysterious chronic illness that almost killed her. Hardy told KUOW's Elizabeth Austin what it was like to live with that mystery and what changed once the disease had a name. Here's Tara Hardy reading her poem, Diagnosis.
This poem begins with an epigraph. Death is my wedding with eternity. Rumi. Diagnosis. And the diagnosis comes down. Like a light snow or a palette of newspapers, read all about it. The diagnosis comes down. It has a name. The name is backlash. The name is antichrist. The name is you've just run out of rollover minutes. The name is welcome to the method of your death. We just don't know when yet. The diagnosis comes down. It sounds like rain in February in Seattle. Repetitive. It has a name. Its name is redundant. Just because it has a name doesn't mean it was making me any less sick before I knew its butchering name. It has a name. The name is Butcher. If Butcher meant genocide, I should not use that word. But still, its real name is not enough for all the things it is extincting in me. The diagnosis comes down in partial crowns to be worn sideways like royalty who are asleep or drunk or passively malevolent. It has a name. Its name is Someday You Too Will Wear This Crown of Human Frailty. Then everyone will look at you like you're the sad homecoming queen at the reunion, twice divorced or widowed by things that have names, cancer, car accident, heart attack. If you want to recognize something, call it by its name. Call it and it will come, roll over, bark. The diagnosis comes down. I want to feel relief, but I feel my anticipated relief dragged into the bushes and beaten. The diagnosis is stuck in my teeth. The diagnosis is stuck in my throat. The diagnosis is written in my chart in someone else's handwriting next to my weight, which I always tell them I don't want to know. Because once I had another diagnosis, culturally prescribed vanity anorexia, and it almost killed me. Sometimes I wonder at what a privilege it was to have vanity before this thing with a name had me turn over my good veins to the nurses on the oncology ward. I remember the lady who put her wig on the handle of her wheelchair. She said, Larry, I'm putting my wig right here. Don't let me forget it. Her diagnosis came down. It had a fistful of hair in its mouth. The diagnosis comes down, and I think, how did I get someone else's diagnosis? No, that's not how you pronounce my name. My name is Grace. My name is Verb. My name is Lilacs in early June, deep purple, early thaw, something to hang your hope on. My name is not sad sack of ballooning skin. My name is not new blue circles under my eyes. My name is not here, crap in this hat, then bring a spoonful to the hospital. My name is not this could kill you at any minute. Have you tied up your affairs lately? My name is not IV immunoglobulin and $40,000 worth of charity chemotherapy. My name is Tara. It is not disease. And just because I have it doesn't mean you get to define me by it or distance yourself from it, meaning me. The diagnosis came down. Verdict, conclusion, incurable. But nonetheless, now something that lives inside me. Let us take her out to dinner. Let us welcome her to the family. Let us rip lettuce with our hands and serve it next to the bread we'll obviously be breaking with our new guest. Welcome, disease. Welcome home to my body that I had previously shared with only a handful of lovers. Welcome to this roof over our heads. You're here for as long as I am, an arranged marriage, so let's make the best of it. Cheers, you've come down. This is my side of the bed, but you're welcome to make me rethink what might be closer to the bathroom. There you are again, I have to pee. There you are again, I have to wheeze. I have to crawl out of this bed of pillows to relieve one pain before I slide back into another. Why did you bring your set of aches? What are you planning to paint on the walls? Do I get to keep my feet? Do I get to keep my heart? Let me keep my heart. This, I ask, disease. If we are going to share a home, then let me keep this four-chapeled room with which I will navigate the world for both of us. There will be a before and an after, a BC and AD of disease. Her name will be as holy as your own. It has to be. Otherwise, there is not enough room in this house. Dear diagnosis, I swear, when I learned your name, I heard wedding bells.
Tara Hardy reading Diagnosis from her collection, My, 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 My. So Tara, where does this poem come in your process of understanding the scale of your chronic illness?
Wow, that's a great question. I got very sick in 2011 and came very close to death five times, was in the hospital. They really couldn't tell me what was happening with me. and I could not get a diagnosis from anyone inside the Western medicine system. So I went from doctor to doctor to doctor, was getting sicker and sicker. My hair was falling out. My platelets were disappearing. At some point, I had a platelet count of zero.
Wow.
Yeah, I was at risk for a brain bleed, basically. And I remember the day that one of the doctors came into my hospital room and she gave me the speech to prepare myself. And I went outside and I thought, I cannot get help from the experts, from the people who are supposed to help me. So I wheeled my, what do you call it, that thing?
The IV pole?
Yes, the IV pole down the hall, down the elevator. I wasn't supposed to go outside, but I went outside at Harborview Hospital, that beautiful park. Parks outside of hospitals are mercy. And I sat in that park and I talked to, there was a crow on a light post, and I talked to a bee that kept buzzing around me, and I talked to the flowers that were in bloom all around me. And I asked the universe to help me stay alive if that's what was meant to happen. And the next day my platelets doubled and they were able to send me home. I'd been in the hospital and nothing they had tried helped me. Shortly after that, I was desperate and terrified enough to go see a doctor who was outside the system. And he's an MD, but he works outside the system, and he specializes in hard-to-diagnose diseases, including Lyme disease. And eventually, his work with me led us to believe that I might have Lyme, and I do. And so he did the test, and that was the day of hope, really, when he was able to diagnose me. But I wrote this poem. I also grieved the day that I got the diagnosis. I celebrated and rejoiced, but I also grieved because I knew friends who had Lyme and the prognosis is not great. And so I wrote this poem the day after I got the diagnosis. Yeah.
And what did writing the poem offer you? Was there a discovery for you in the writing of the poem?
Yeah. It offered me an opportunity to, one, answer the people who had been asking me the question, what do you have? What do you have?
Right.
What do you have?
Right.
As if it were their business, right? As if just being deathly ill wasn't enough, right? And I think we ask people, I don't think it's malicious, but I think we ask people those questions, what do you have? Sometimes as a means to distance ourselves from, I want to make sure that I'm alive, you know, or I want to make sure that I'm not at risk for that. So it was an answer to that, but it was also a welcoming, because that was the day that it broke open for me that I knew I had to welcome this literal creature that will live in my body for the rest of my life. And if I were to be at war with that creature, it would be a different experience. I just knew that I had to have some kind of perhaps even symbiotic relationship with the disease that lives in me.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense,
it helps me understand that very wonderfully strange opening metaphor, the quote from Rumi about death being a kind of marriage and the way you close the poem. I also couldn't help thinking all the way through hearing you read this poem about how much writing poetry is about naming.
Yeah, totally. And I don't name the disease in the poem.
I know. I thought, so my question for you about that is that an intentional choice to allow me as the listener to hear my own possibilities?
Yes, absolutely. And to find yourself in it, and for other people who are ill to find themselves in it too, and to also not answer that question, what do you have, what do you have, what do you have? To really, because we are all susceptible. We are all vulnerable as bodies, you know? And so what do I have? The answer really is human frailty. The answer really is vulnerability. That's what I have. And the diagnosis
is mortality.
Yes. Yes. And we all have it, whether we're in touch with it or not. And I think in Western culture that we aren't as in touch with it as I think some other cultures are. And I think it's actually a disservice that we do to people. Because one of the other things that's happened for me is that spending an entire year of my life believing that I could and would likely die at any moment has opened my life in a brand new way. I don't miss a sunset. If I'm driving home from work and I see the sun setting, I go watch the sparkle on the water, you know? I don't pass up the mangoes at the grocery store anymore, you know? Yeah, so it's opened my life a lot.
You just met Seattle poet Tara Hardy, talking there with KUOW's Elizabeth Austin. Earlier, you heard Tara read Diagnosis. Wasn't that amazing? That's from her collection, My, published by Right Bloody Press. Tara just won the Washington Book Award for Poetry for that book this month. You can hear that poem again. You can read about Tara Hardy at KUOW.org. So good to have you along on KUOW's The Record. We are on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. France does it. Several European countries do. Now it's come to North America. Quebec has banned public workers from wearing a burqa or a veil across their face. That means doctors, teachers. It even applies to people riding a public bus. Here with more is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hiya, Vaughn.
Good morning, Bill. Canada getting international attention for this one. I see we even made the New York Times with this news.
Yes, yes. And the law we're talking about, it just refers to face coverings, but yes. Do the proponents acknowledge that this is aimed at the burqas and the face veils worn by some Muslims?
I think that's pretty obvious. Yeah. You're right. It doesn't say that. What it says is you can't wear face coverings when receiving or granting government services. So that's where you get, obviously, doctors and lawyers, but public servants who work behind counters at the motor vehicle branch. And it also applies to people coming in to get those services. They have to uncover their faces. So, for example, if you're picking up your children after school or from a child care center, you have to uncover your face so that they can identify you. If you're trying to use your bus pass, uncover your face.
What about somebody who wants to go to a government doctor?
Well, this is where we get into the murky area. The government, give you an idea how controversial this is, since I sent you the background on this, the government in Quebec has again come out and clarified what the law means. So they're now saying, well, you know, you wouldn't be denied emergency health services, and you could cover your face after you showed your bus pass to the bus driver, so you wouldn't be kept off the bus. And you might have to you would have to uncover your face to use your library card, but you wouldn't have to uncover your face to walk up and down the aisles of the public library. So this is going on. They're still clarifying this. A couple of other points worth noting on this, Bill, is that there's no penalty section in this legislation. There's no penalty for doing any of this. And the government says it's not going to have a bunch of cops going around making people uncover their faces. It will likely be challenged in court, but it's not really clear how broadly this is going to apply. There's a sense that it may mostly be a symbolic declaration, particularly given the absence of penalty section in the bill.
This is a first, as I said, Vaughn, in North America. Yeah. Why is it that banning these face coverings is so important to some Quebecois?
We should make it really clear, Bill, that this is a division of public opinion in Canada. The most English Canadian commentators and politicians have denounced this. Almost 90% of the people in Quebec say they support this, and many of them, including the opposition parties there, say it doesn't go far enough. They want even stronger. It's rooted in a couple of things. One is the history of Quebec as a French society that has tried to maintain its culture and identity within a sea of English people in North America. It's connected to a concern that immigrants are coming in and, I guess, diluting the Quebec culture or taking on a different identity. Part of it is the long struggle in Quebec to separate church and state, a very powerful Catholic church, particularly in the 19th century. And the other thing is a link to Europe. And as you know, Bill, you pointed out in your introduction, there's lots of countries in Europe where these bans are in place. Many of them have been upheld by the courts. France does it. Germany does it. Norway's looking at it. So in that sense, Quebec, part of maintaining their distinct identity in Canada for French Canadians is to maintain a tie and an awareness to Europe. So what they're saying to English Canada is, look, this isn't as sort of off the mainstream as you think it is. It's commonplace in European countries, and we have our reasons for doing it. And, you know, one of the backlashes against the government there, Bill, the Liberal government, for changing and clarifying parts of this bill is they're now being attacked by their critics, by their opposition parties, as, quote, giving in to English Canada, standing down some provisions in the bill to please English Canada. So this is a very, very deep divide in Canada. And talk about two worlds seeing things differently. English and French in Canada don't see this legislation the same way at all.
And Vaughn, we have just about a half a minute left. What's the argument opponents are making? You said that this law is being challenged in court.
They think it'll be challenged in court, although if they aren't going to enforce it and they aren't going to fine people, not 100% clear exactly how it will be in court. But yes, I expect it will be dragged into the Canadian courts, challenged under the grounds of the Canadian constitutional right to freedom of religion.
We'll see whether it holds up in Canadian court. That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. And Vaughn, in just a second, it sounds like no chance of this happening in British Columbia anytime soon.
No. Yeah. English Canada doesn't see the sense of this at all.
Right. Vancouver Sun's Vaughn Palmer. Great to talk with you again, Vaughn. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
On KUOW's The Record.